Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be talking about in this episode are the top 300 trade, hardcover, softcover, graphic novel, collected edition sales through Diamond to retailers, predominantly in North America. This is based on what is invoiced to the retailers, so it's what's sold from the publisher perspective, but not what we bought from a reader perspective, because again, we've got the retailers in there in that middleman sort of position. It's one of those things that it's... The split really isn't all that exciting usually on the trades list. We had DC come in with 34.82% of the units for the top 300 trades. Marvel 24.06% of the units, and Image 20.62%. You add everybody else up and you get obviously that remaining roughly quarter of the pie or whatever. Actually, it's about 20.49%. This kind of a split's not highly unusual. It is interesting, though, how by dollars it kind of splits out slightly differently. 36.67% going to DC, 29.01 to Marvel, 14.09 to Image. So we're seeing basically a reflection there of the higher average price at Marvel and the lower average price at Image, and then that remaining 20.22% going to everybody else.
Mm-hmm. And it is also just to look and see that for new items, DC and Marvel are usually putting out between 25 and 30 a month. But then DC, with their commitment to their backlist, you know, 62 reorder, and their commitment to making sure they have enough in stock and willing to keep things on the shelf, unlike Marvel. Although Marvel has made some changes in that category, but the long tail has definitely benefited DC in that sense. 62 reorder items to 34 for Marvel.
Well, I think some of that's not only a reflection of their commitment to keeping things in print, as you point out, which is, frankly, a really big deal. Doesn't matter what your content is if you don't keep it in print. But I think also there are sections of the DC lineup, I'm thinking specifically the Vertigo area, among others, that are just a bit more evergreen on the trade side.
That's true.
Marvel really doesn't have much of that. It'll be interesting to see over the years if the Star Wars property becomes something like that for them. It may not. It's hard to tell. But they don't have, over at Marvel, kind of the equivalent of Fables, Sandman, Preacher, Hellblazer, you know, those kind of long-running but somewhat low-selling on the comic side, but they make up for it on the trade side kind of things that DC predominantly had through the Vertigo imprint.
That's a good point.
But for that matter, DC doesn't really have that currently either in terms of new material.
That's true.
So it's going to be interesting to see if the strength of the backlist for DC continues to be from some of those older kind of evergreen titles, or if we start to see other things kind of show up on the list.
Yeah, I think it's especially true that they realize they have the older material from Vertigo that's, you know, the kind of their consistent seller, and they realize the last couple years of Vertigo has not been an overall success. There may be, you know, a title every once in a while that has sold decently. So, you know, you see them moving with that, the Gerard Way line, the Young Animal line. They're trying to kind of rebrand Vertigo if that, you know, is successful, is kind of have that be the new version of Vertigo. And we'll see. Only time will tell. It's very early for those books.
It is. I've only read, I think just the first Doom Patrol. I don't think I've read any of the others yet. Do you think the Young Animal imprint will have that kind of sales impact on the trade side?
You know what? To be honest with you, I think in today's market, with the numbers and the way the public, it's very hard to hold the public's attention. I think it's very difficult to have another scenario where you have 6 to 8 to 12 books that have really good evergreen sales titles like the old Vertigo did, you know, where you have Why the Last Man, Preacher, you know, all those kind of like consistent 60 issue runs. I think in today's market where you barely can get single issues to 12 before you have to revolume, I think the comics reader, you know, the span of their attention and the amount of product on the market that keeps coming out, I think it's very difficult to build those long-term successes.
I've got to imagine it's going to be even harder with somebody who, for all intents and purposes, is an outsider in the form of Gerard Way as kind of the guiding force for that line.
Yeah, and I think part of it is, you know, with, you know, when Karen Berger left, they turned it over to, I think, Shelley Bond, and they kind of gave a really big push trying to reinvigorate Vertigo. And when that wasn't successful and they let her go, I think they said, well, we tried to really push how, you know, what was successful us in the past. We really need to have a paradigm shift, and we really need to try something completely different. And I think that's what this Young Animal is. Now, their version of completely different may not be what the market thinks is completely different, and the market may just think these are strange weirdo books and we don't want them, but we have to wait and find out. But I think this is they're definitely trying, in my opinion, you know, at least branding wise and bringing in creators that are, you know, not necessarily the same people that have been doing books all the time, you know, the Brian Michael Bendis's. They're trying, at least. It is interesting, I think.
No, they're definitely trying, and I certainly respect that. I hope it works. I guess what I'm wondering at the moment is Karen Berger at Vertigo, she defined Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
She created the imprint. She guided it for, 15, 20 years? I forget how long. I mean, forever, essentially, up until, again, recently when she left. Do you think the defining characteristic was a sensibility about what comics to pick? So kind of a tone, a style, and what to greenlight? Or do you think the bigger contributing factor to the Vertigo success was just really strong, really good editorial oversight on the ongoing side?
You know, I think it's that's a very good question and a very hard question to answer, in terms of, I almost wonder if Vertigo, that great success that they had in that, you know, what is it, 10, 15 year period, was almost a confluence of events where it was those things. You know, she had a good eye for finding talent. She had a good eye for investing, but also the market allowed for comics to run for a long time and have a series be supported beyond 15 issues. I really think part of the draw for Vertigo, especially for me when I was getting back into comics, was that you had these worlds that you didn't have to read. You have these, you know, properties that you didn't have to read 15 crossovers across 6 different books. You could read one trade to the next, to the next, to the next, for a contained story that made sense. The characters developed, the creators usually stayed the same. And that was a big draw for complex stories, you know, beat 'em up superhero stories. You know, there's a certain amount of repetitiveness and you can always start over and you see the general themes. Whereas in a lot of Vertigo work, which really drew me in, was that there was a beginning, middle, and end to most of those stories. You saw the characters develop. They didn't reset the pieces to zero most of the time. Every once in a while they did. But you could really see that there was a beginning and an end to the story, and you weren't going to have to just, you know, just like an X-Men story. Well, this character might be dead for two years, but he'll come back. So there was real stakes almost in a lot of those Vertigo books. And a lot of them were aimed towards more mature readers, so they could deal with more mature themes. And I think all that created a sense for long form storytelling. You know what I mean? Almost like novels written over 60 issues, big, beefy novels. And I think that was a big part of their success. In this market, I just don't know if that's possible anymore on a great scale. You're always going to have breakouts like Saga, you know what I mean? But that's not or The Walking Dead, but that's not a repeatable formula. You know, there's not a repeatable formula that anyone's been able to lock onto.
Well, let me throw this out, because obviously Karen Berger didn't just come out of nowhere when they formed Vertigo. She'd been working at DC for a while. She'd been editing other books. And that was back in a time frame where you had kind of what I would refer to as the never-ending saga mentality or never-ending battle kind of mentality of books, where you were following the life of Superman, of Batman, of the Teen Titans, of the Legion of Superheroes. Things would happen, things would ramp up, things would ramp down. They'd be kind of a little bit more intertwining of plot, subplot, and not the hard lines between the beginning of the story and the end of the story, and those almost firewalls between arcs, if you will. So could it be that she had successfully developed an editorial style that really worked for that kind of storytelling, which was the dominant form back then? Because at that point, there really weren't that even many miniseries or limited series coming.
Yeah, no, I think you make a very good point. I think that it's almost like, has the comics medium, the fan base, does it lack the tolerance for taking its time telling stories now? You know, I don't, it's kind of a chicken and egg scenario, right? Like creators would, I think most creators would love to tell a 30, you know, 30 issue story arc, but will the numbers and the, you know, the way that the industry works now support that? You're absolutely right. You know, back then, you know, you could follow stories. Everything wasn't as episodic, or, you know, you couldn't, you know, because of the trade market, everything isn't, we have to get this story done in six issues for the trade kind of thing. So I think that's a very good point, is that that's what I mean. It's just almost like, was her, I'm not trying to denigrate her in any way. I think she was amazing. I think a large portion of the success was her ability to pick out creators she knew she could trust to do long form storytelling that were really good at it. But it's almost like, was she a product of her time in that environment? But I guess you could say that about anyone in any era of the comics era, right? Stan Lee, same way, you know?
Well, I'm almost wondering, is it less that she was a product of her time, but that she had the foresight to maintain what became in the mainstream superhero books an antiquated storytelling format of, again, they shifted to the arcs with the hard stop between them, whereas she wasn't doing that. I think if you were to look back at some of her the titles she edited in the superhero line, I'm thinking specifically the Legion of Superheroes, because that's about the only one off the top of my head I can think of that I know she edited. And that was one where there were arcs, there were storylines, but they flowed through the course of the series. And it's not like you hit the end of the Great Darkness Saga and boom, cold start on the next arc kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Subplots flow through. And if she just had the wherewithal as an editor to say, no, let's keep doing that. But if you're going to keep doing that, you've got to keep the stories accessible, because it's easy to not do that, and then people, it's like, well, I'm lost, I don't know how to follow it. And if she basically maintained that 80s sort of a storytelling style through the 90s, you know, and beyond, and it became kind of the hallmark of Vertigo because everybody else left that format behind.
Yeah, I think that is a good point. It's almost like you develop, you know, she developed that niche and she got very good at it. And, you know, you have to admit, for everyone, she got a little bit lucky, right? There is a few creators that, you know, she couldn't have known that were going to be that good or produce that great of work, some of the best work in the industry. And, you know, she created, I think, a kind of like a contract with the readers that were always willing to try Vertigo books, because they knew that it would be a relatively continuous story, and that for the majority of them, as long as it sold, you know, it didn't sell terribly at the beginning, there would be support for a long story, which I think a lot of, you know, as people aged up in comics, a lot of people really enjoy, you know, an in-depth story. At least I do.
Yeah. You know? I do think there's a certain amount of, with some creators, she definitely did get lucky. Mm-hmm. But I think there's also an aspect of having an eye for talent.
Oh, absolutely.
And the ability to nurture talent successfully.
Well, and I think one of the things that's underrated is when she had success, she built on that success and really made the Vertigo brand shine. And she was also able to keep convince the people at DC, and maybe she didn't need to do as much convincing as, say, as she had been at Marvel, to keep stuff in print. You know, that has always been an issue for me with Marvel, is sometimes I want to go back and get some of the older stuff since I was out of comics reading for a while, and it's just so hard to read. Now, digital makes that easier now, but before that, but whereas when I got back into comics reading, it was exclusively reading Vertigo for about a month because it was available.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think her, I don't want to say clout as an editor, but the fact that the early Vertigo stuff came out of the mainstream DC titles. Sandman was coming off of the Sandman legacy of characters over, you know, at DC, from the JSA all the way up through Infinity Inc. and some others. Then you had Swamp Thing that was, again, coming out of the mainstream DC universe with Hellblazer or John Constantine. Obviously, Doom Patrol, mainstream DC line. She got it to where once they kind of got into the Vertigo area, she was able to kind of really walk this fine line between, yeah, they're still part of the DC universe, so if it makes sense to pull Superman or Batman in for a Swamp Thing story, sure. But they're also kind of separate. They're off in their own little corner without becoming kind of the redheaded stepchild or something. So, again, the brand building and awareness, both in terms of maintaining the Vertigo line as it is, but also not letting just anybody and their dog on the mainstream side play with those toys and wreck, kind of tainting the brand, if you will. So I think there's some definite skill she had in terms of how she built up that imprint, from a brand perspective, from a content perspective, and I'm wondering if with the young animals, there is a misconception that, no, it was the wacky content that was what made it successful.
Well, and I think one of her most successful things, too, is by having such a strong brand and such a clear message about what kind of books were created at Vertigo, as she built on success after success, the creators went, like for instance, the last couple of years at Image, once things start having positive, you have this positive, you know, things going well, you have this positive feedback loop, and everyone realizes you can make a lot of money at Image if you're successful, especially if you're already an established creator. In the same way, once Karen Berger had Vertigo rolling and people saw that's where you could go tell sometimes dark but complicated adult stories, the creators that were most likely to desire that and were willing to commit to that long form project were more likely to try and pitch their ideas there first, right? So that, but that's due to her hard work to get that rolling and to get that positive cycle building up.
Well, and I think she also developed a reputation for being a good editor to work with.
Absolutely.
So I think there are a lot of things that contribute to the success of Vertigo, and not just back then, but again, the ongoing success we're continuing to see. And I think that's a hard thing to duplicate.
Oh, absolutely. That's why when you ask me if the young animals is going to be successful, I think the odds are stacked against anything being long-term successful in comics in general, you know, outside of just having the brands of DC or Marvel. Or, you know, I think Image has really obviously established itself, but I think it's just really hard to be successful with almost anything.
Well, I would even say the long-term brands.
Yeah.
Because we've seen, just again, with the New 52, to a lesser degree with Rebirth, the main DC brand kind of shifting around a little bit. With Marvel going through the Marvel Now, the all different, the, you know, the various rotating brandings of it, almost sort of but not quite defining their quote-unquote seasons. Mm-hmm. Really defining what the Marvel brand is kind of hard right now.
Absolutely.
So, interesting stuff.
Yeah.
And I really think the trade side shows what has legs, what is, mm-hmm. is, you know, got that potential for that long-term success.
Well, and I think it also shows what word of mouth, and obviously in today's social media age, that can be a different thing. But, you know, for the longest time, I think word of mouth from comics buyers, you know, oh, you really need to check this out. You know, when you get in your shop and you talk about the stuff that's coming out and you find out what other people like, and they mention stuff that may not be easily found in the single issues anymore, you know, because a lot of comic shops don't have a lot of bin depth. But now that with the collected editions and digital, you know, when someone tells you, oh, man, you got to check this out. You know, if you've a creator that's putting something out now, and then someone who has a little bit more experience in the medium says, oh, if you like his stuff here, he did this great series 10 years ago. And, you know, with the collected editions, obviously, that's one of the most accessible forms of the backstock. And especially for Vertigo, a lot of the creators that are still working today in the industry, you know, they have Vertigo series. You know, look at Jason Aaron. I mean, Scalped is amazing. And a lot of people who, you know, are accessing his stuff through Marvel or Image, you know, they may not even know about Scalped, but once they hear about it, there's, you know, that's a great 60 issue run.
Mm-hmm. No, certainly. I think that is how a lot of the older material kind of stays on the list sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
There are other cases. I think Preacher's a good example of it this month, where with the TV show, I think a whole new audience is getting introduced to that property on the comic book side.
Mm-hmm.
But going to your other point of kind of the word of mouth thing, how much of the trade sales do you think are a little bit more of a meritocracy? Because by the time the collected edition comes out, trade hardcover, it's already gone through not just kind of the review cycle, but the full story has gone through the review cycle.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, you know, you hear that from Brian Hibbs all the time. Things that sell poorly in single issues sell poorly in trade. Things that sell well in single issues sell well in trade. Obviously, there are margins where that's not true. Oftentimes, you know, the big events at Marvel or DC will sell very well in single issues just because, you know, that's the inertia of the industry in events. And maybe that won't be in the future, but, you know, they sell a couple hundred thousand copies. But then may they sell nothing in trades because everyone realizes they're terrible, but they've double shipped them. So they're halfway into it anyways, and they got to finish it out. You know what I mean?
I think there's some books that way, but I think just as we discussed with Vertigo, there are some types of books that lends itself to the deeper read, if you will, and therefore mm-hmm. the bigger installment is advantageous.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is why we see some of those books not doing so well, those titles not doing so well on the comic side, but doing disproportionately better than your average trade would based on those sorts of sales.
I'll give you a great current example. The Omega Men by Tom King and I can't remember the artist, but that DC series that was basically canceled for low sales on the single issues, but then revived after a lot of like online angst that it was being canceled. And then the trade, the 12-issue trade, went on, the whole series went on to, I believe, in either the New York Times bestseller list for graphic novels or one of those lists. So successful, for, comparatively successful as a graphic novel, as a completed 12-issue, you know, one book, especially compared to the, you know, dismal single-issue sales.
Well, that Omega Men, The End Is Here, is actually at rank 42 on the direct market list here.
Mm-hmm. So actually did pretty well comparative for how well it did in the singles.
2,029 units, whereas most of the issues were doing below 10,000.
Yeah.
And that's one where it's like, is it even worth printing at that point or publishing at that point for DC?
Well, I think that they had made the decision no, and then they got so much online feedback that that was a terrible idea that they revived it, you know, for the full 12 issue run. So
yeah, because again, it was canceled at the six and then continued for the other six. Yeah,
and you know, part of that I almost wonder is if they knew that they were going to be potentially making an offer for King to write Batman and they didn't want to piss him off, or they just wanted to keep him in good graces, and seeing as he's one of the top new writers in the last couple of years, they, you know, maybe saw some synergy with keeping that book going.
I think there's definitely an aspect of creator relations that factor into what titles continue and which don't. Because there are a couple where, even if it doesn't make necessarily financial sense to do a book or to keep a book going, it's good for just the relationship with the creator. The two that are popping to mind in this respect for me, and I'm not saying it is the case, I'm just saying I could understand where it could be the case to do projects with them just because you want to, I don't want to say stay in their good graces, but have good relations with them. The Firestorm title that was kind of inside of Legends of Tomorrow with Jerry Conway, which was kind of sort of just continuing the last Firestorm title. And it was one of those where, you know, I don't think there were enough people crying out, oh, please continue with Firestorm to warrant that title. But, you know, if you've got somebody who's created a number of characters and whatnot that are actually doing very well for you over on television and stuff, does it hurt to stay good with the guy and say, hey, yeah, you want to finish the story? Here's another six issues. We're going to do it as part of this anthology book, but, you know, you can still do it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The other one I'm thinking of is, you know, things like Batman Odyssey, Superman, The Coming of the Supermen. You know, when you've got a big name creator who says, hey, I'd like to do something with one of these characters, or whatever caused those projects to happen, it kind of makes sense to say, you know, okay, he's a big enough deal and just a brilliant artist. Oh, he wants to write the thing too? Yeah, well, I guess we'll let him.
you know, it's an interesting corollary, but it's not at all related to the not financially successful, because I'm sure that this series is successful. When Scott Snyder left Batman, and they gave him the other Batman series where he gets to have, you know, artists, you know, fancy artists come through. I forget what the name of the title is. The
All-Star Batman?
All-Star Batman. Obviously, like, Scott Snyder's successful. He made that Batman run successful. It's not like they would be worried about the sales. But I almost wonder if part of that, them keeping him there, was to prevent him from doing or disincentivize him. Because, maybe he had plenty of Batman stories left he wanted to tell, which I don't doubt. But also part of it was, we don't want this guy going over to Marvel and doing what he did for Batman to one of their characters. So we want to keep offering him work and keep him happy here, and not give him any sort of incentive to, you know, look at the other side of the street.
Well, and again, he kept Batman above 100,000 for its entire 52 volume.
Yeah, I wasn't implying that they would give it to him as a pity thing, but you know what I mean? Like, yeah.
But I'm saying it's the exact almost opposite rationale in that case. It's, he's doing so well for us, let's pay that back, let's keep him happy, and to your point, let's keep him on our side of the street.
Yeah.
Or in this case, our coast versus, you know.
Yeah, let's give him enough projects where he can't reasonably think about taking a Marvel project, because it's just like that thing. I think for your top line creators, I think it's very, there's this fine line of like, they're with you. And then if they have time for another project and, you know, sometimes the, you know, someone offers them something else and they're gone, you know?
Well, and the ability to say, hey, we're going to give you another Batman book, but the shtick here is we only want the biggest of big names on it artistically.
Yeah.
So you're going to get to work with those sorts of people. I mean, that's an incentive right there.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's probably one of the main reasons they probably designed the book that way to entice him to keep doing it, you know, because maybe he had been, you know, I don't know. Maybe he said, you know, I've just done the last couple of years on Batman. I'm a little burnt out. Maybe I need some time off. Maybe I'll try a few different types of stories. And they're like, well, what about this? You know, if you still have a few Batman stories, what if you just had to work with nothing but top flight artists? Like, you always got these awesome, awesome artists. And he's like, ooh, you know?
Yeah, nothing but dream collaborations. How about that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, hard to turn that down.
Yeah, exactly. And hard to then take a Marvel project, so.
Yeah. Well, and I think we're seeing enough exclusives being signed on, I think, both sides of the fence. I'm noticing more on the DC in terms of the news releases. But I think if you've got somebody who's doing good work for you, it's advantageous to kind of lock them in.
Mm-hmm.
It's good for the creator because they get, you know, presumably a better page rate, some guaranteed sales, a bit more financial stability.
And health insurance oftentimes. So that's a big plus too.
Health insurance, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And if it means, you know, you've kind of prevented your competitors from getting that person over there, that's advantageous too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something that at times comics, from a creative standpoint, seems like it's got both an incredibly large bench of potential people to pick from, but also at times an incredibly shallow bench of people that get picked, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think there are some creators that have kind of, I'm going to say aged out, but I don't mean that in terms of having just gotten too old, but in terms of the sensibility is no longer, of the writer is no longer in alignment with the audience.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, it's creators that don't adjust with the times. In other cases, it's they're actually really, really good at what they do. The audience just, for whatever reason, doesn't want it anymore. And it just seems like, again, there's so many writers and artists out there that it shouldn't be a problem to stack a roster full of titles with you know, known, recognizable, and respected creators.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's who's available, who wants to work with who wants to work on which project, and who likes dealing with which editor and such.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to, again, Vertigo never seemed to have a problem getting people to sign on board, so strong, solid editor, that's worth a lot.
Mm-hmm.
If we jump over to the top 300 list, top in the list this time around is Star Wars Darth Vader Volume 3 trade paperback. 7,098 units. Again, Marvel's doing well with the Star Wars property. That's no surprise. To me, it's just a question of, are these things going to have staying power, or do they top the list and then just kind of fade down the list and fade away over time? You know, another couple of years from now, are we still going to see the Darth Vader title showing up?
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I think one of the things that is in Disney's favor is they're obviously committed to this for decades, right? They bought that, you know, just like Disneyland with their theme parks, they're going to milk this for the next 30, 40 years. You know, they have the IP. So it's not like they're going to have Star Wars go away. It'll just be an interesting, idea of, will it be just successful for short periods of time, or will they be able to really build on it? So,
well, and does it go through the phase it's going through now, or for the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to have a movie a year?
Mm-hmm.
But then after that, have they done too many too fast?
That's a good point.
You know, does it fade away for a little bit, and then they're relying on the books and the comics to kind of keep the property active, but not kind of hyperactive in terms of movie and TV? Or,
mm-hmm.
You know, because, I mean, we've seen Star Trek go kind of a little, I don't say cyclical, but we've seen it have up and downs in terms of popularity.
Absolutely.
You know, so they're doing good stuff. They're putting good creators on it. We'll see how that goes. Second item on the list, Batman the Killing Joke Special Edition Hardcover. This is reorder activity. It's shown up 21 times before. Did another 163 units. Again, it had the video Blu-ray special come out.
Yeah.
That Suicide Squad Joker is you know on people's minds these days.
Mm-hmm.
The third one, though, man, this surprised me a little bit. Black Panther Volume 1, Nation Under Our Feet. Black Panther's not somebody I would have thought would have kind of, you know, topped the trades list. But 6,764 units is pretty good.
Well, I think as good as that is for on the direct market, I think with the way this book has been praised in the kind of literatia, I guess I would call it, because of the author, featured in the New York Times, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I bet the sales on Amazon and those markets are insane compared to these numbers, like many multiples.
I would like to know.
Mm-hmm.
Because while I think he's got a definite kind of pedigree as an established author and such, how many of those people who know him from that are going to want to read a comic?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's especially what I mean by this first issue, I think, is being bought on and not even in the direct market. I mean, in things like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, those other places, is being bought on his kind of cultural standing. And I would love to see the numbers compared to the second volume, because I completely agree. A lot of people are buying this, especially outside the direct market, based on his work outside of the comics medium. And when they get their hands on this, they may be like, what the hell is this? I don't understand how you tell the story this way. They may have no, you know what I mean? They may be so foreign to them because they see him as an intellectual writer and a literary writer. So they just don't, this is going to be completely different for them. So I think the real interesting part would look at to see how Volume 2 does. And obviously, we don't have access to those numbers outside because most of those people are going to be buying it through Amazon and Barnes & Noble and places like that. So, you know, we won't necessarily see what the comparison is between the first volume and the second. But that is what will really tell you, did these people accept the storytelling medium? Or did they go, oh, I really like this writer, but I do not understand I don't understand these comic things.
Well, and that points out, I think, one of the easiest things to overlook about the difference between the direct market and the mass market. Direct market readers know how to read a comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Mass market readers may or may not.
Oh, absolutely.
And I've known a couple of people that they really like digital comics because of the guided view technology, mm-hmm. which is walking them through what to read next.
Yeah. I can guarantee you that this this comic, it for a huge portion of the people that are buying it outside the direct market is the first time they've read a comic book, because there's a lot of sales of this to like 40-year-olds that have never bought a comic, but they read the New Yorker and they read his think pieces. And so they're expecting a certain type of writing and tone and style. So, and I don't know how they're going to react to the words and picture thing.
Well, yeah, even if they were willing to accept him doing fictional work and just regular prose, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They know how to read a novel.
Yeah, exactly.
They may not know how to read a comic book.
Oh, yeah. And there's going to be a lot of people that this is their first comic book. And a lot of those people, and this may be presumptuous of me, are the people that look down on comics as an expressive form. You know what I mean? So it's going to be even harder, I think, for them to be like, well, I don't understand.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that does in the mass market.
Yeah.
Because I think you're right. I think this is one that's going to perform differently in the mass market than your average kind of trade would.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's gotten reviews in the New York Times and, you know, the Washington Post and places like that. How often do you get a collected edition get reviews in those platforms? And it's primarily because of his cultural cred, basically, and the work he's done previously in other, you know, this is a guy that is in the cultural zeitgeist in that area is kind of in his prime right now. So there's a lot of focus outside the direct market on him. And it'll just be interesting to see if the direct market or outside the direct market, if they accept this form of storytelling. Because the funny thing is he really loves comics. And he in interviews in some of those fancy places has talked about how much he loves Jonathan Hickman's world building and things like he actually reads a lot of comics, which is, I think, great. But I just don't think his general audience understands comics. You know what I mean? So it'll be interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate you using the term collected edition versus graphic novel.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, this is collecting individual issues.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, whenever somebody says, yeah, Watchmen was a great graphic novel, I wasn't told originally in that format. Now, yeah. Granted, now we've got the original graphic novel versus, you know.
Yeah. Well, you should point them to the new DC version of The Watchmen, where each issue is in a hardcover in a 12 hardcover box set. And you should point them towards that.
Yes, yes. If you want to read it in the graphic novel format, just empty your wallet here. Yeah, it's funny because the reason that distinction is important is there are so few things that are being done in the original to graphic novel format.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got one of them on the list here down at rank number 8, and that's Teen Titans Earth 1 Volume 2. And it's part of the whole Earth 1 series of hardcovers they're doing. It did 6,221 units, which is not too bad. But this is one where I really wonder how this Earth 1 is going to get any sort of momentum behind it, given the snail's pace at which they're releasing these hardcovers.
Yeah, that's a good point.
They've done, what, 2, maybe 3 of the Superman ones. I think Wonder Woman, maybe 1, maybe 2 Batmans. This is the second Teen Titans. I'm trying to think if they've done any others. It's just they've been doing it for a couple of years now, too.
Yeah, they've done the Superman, the Batman, the Teen Titans. And they just came out with the Wonder Woman one in the last 6 to 8 months, didn't they?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah,
they did. I've not read the Wonder Woman one. Not sure that I've... Well, obviously, I haven't read the Teen Titans one that just came out recently, too. Thinking I've read some of the... I've read a lot of the others. Sam and I did a back-issue spotlight on some of them. And they're good. They're interesting. It's just hard to really consider that a viable world on an ongoing basis when it's just in fits and spurts.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's funny because I feel that they're telling a longer equivalent of an issue versus a full story in some of these trades.
Mm-hmm.
But it just comes down to story momentum. And I do think that's one of the things where trades have a huge advantage over the single issues, is just being able to get a full story in one sitting, lock, stock, and barrel.
Mm-hmm.
If we go to rank 6, we've got Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, that hardcover, collecting the full miniseries, 6,584 units. And if we go further down, a title that I think may have flown under a lot of people's radar is Superman, Lois, and Clark. We've got a trade paperback there at 3,006 units. And I believe that collects the entire run of that series.
No, I think it does. You know, what's interesting is I have that sitting on my desk. I haven't read it yet, but I've heard great things actually from a number of people about it.
I've enjoyed it quite a bit, and it's more or less the prequel, if you will, to the current Superman title.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's setting them up in the new 52 universe before he takes over as Superman.
Yeah. No, I just heard I hadn't originally ordered it because I, don't read a lot of superhero stuff, as especially in the Superman hasn't been, in my opinion, great lately. But I just heard enough raves about it that I picked it up on in stock trades and just have it sitting on my desk. It's near the top of the pile, but you know how that goes.
Yeah. I would say, though, if you're going to read Superman stuff right now, Action Comics.
Okay.
To me, that is one of the best comics out in a while. There's something about the art style, the storytelling. It's just really working for me. Now, another one, I'm going to start jumping around the list a bit here that I want to talk about. Rank 46, we've got Arrow with the Dark Archer, trade paperback, 1,933 units. This is one that I haven't read yet. It's written by John Barrowman and his sister Carol Barrowman, and it's the backstory for Malcolm Merlyn in Arrow.
Oh, okay.
And it's kind of cool that they got the actor who's, you know, done some other writing and stuff to do this. But it's also one of the things that was a digital first project.
Mm-hmm.
So technically it's not original to trade, but it's the first time it's been in print.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I respect that they're doing that. And again, getting Barrowman involved, I think, was just a really smart move.
Absolutely.
He mentioned it at the Dallas convention I was at. You know, again, he's a smart man. He's going to, you know, promote what he's doing. But I do think there's a lot of things that the DC is doing with their digital first stuff that I think is just very interesting to watch. Mm-hmm. Because some of the stuff kind of floats beneath people's radar and then kind of pops out. This is one that, again, might do better in the mass market than it does in the direct market. Because, again, mass market people are going to see the cover, recognize him from the show, and, okay, maybe I'll check that out or something.
Uh-huh.
Whereas in the direct market, there are a lot of people, yeah, but it's not in the mainstream DC universe, could be a factor.
Mm-hmm.
But I look at how much success they've had with the comics they've done. And I'm not saying, wow, they've blown the doors off sales or whatever, but they continue to produce comics based on Arrow, Flash, Supergirl. They have, I don't think they've done one on Legends of Tomorrow yet that I'm aware of. But then the longevity of the Injustice Gods Among Us universe, I find just amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, that, again, is about as old or slightly older than the New 52 itself.
Yeah, I know that they're bringing that to a close at the end of, you know, the fifth year, but that has been a great run.
Well, they're stopping the year naming, and they're replacing it with another series that tells the story of the first game from Harley's perspective. There's a second game coming out, and you know they're going to either bridge the gap or do something there.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
In other words, I don't think it's ending anytime soon.
Yeah.
And again, I just find that phenomenal that, because some of the digital first stuff comes and goes. The Ami Kami Girls came and went. DC Bombshells is still, I think, an ongoing concern. The Batman 66, I'm not sure if that's still ongoing or not. But they've had a surprising amount of success with that kind of virtual imprint, if you will. And that's something that Marvel, when they do stuff, is doing the Infinite Comic kind of a deal, where instead of doing something that's a bit more translatable, directly translatable to the page, it's a swipe, swipe, swipe to get the different word balloons and stuff. It's a quasi-animation. And to me, that's not what I'm looking for in digital comics.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe somebody is. Let's see, we talked about Preacher a little. We've got the first volume at rank 26 with 2,666 units. The second volume at rank 82 with 1,384 units. And I didn't think to look further down if we've got further volumes of that. Again, TV show that I think is hopefully introducing it to a whole nother audience. Yeah, we've got volume 3 down at rank 137 with 931 units. Volume 4 at rank 173 with 773 units. And then 5 at rank 221 with 618 units. And 6 at rank 236 with 568 units. And that's the full run, I believe. And some of these may be hardcovers, though. This is one of those where I think you've called me on this before, and I haven't changed the system, where they were doing volumes of trades, then they were doing books of hardcovers, and my system may have gotten a little confused.
So how you differentiate it, and this is just from someone who literally only works in the trade. You know, I only deal with trades, so I know these numbers. When DC does single 5 to 6 issue trades, and they're trade paperbacks, you're looking at a $14.99 or $16.99. This is actually how you kind of differentiate if they don't specifically say book versus trade, you know, storyline. The pricing is actually how you work it out. When it's one of their paperbacks that's two trades combined for one of their books, it's $19.99. Or if it's a real, you know, a few more issues than the normal 10, you're looking at $24.99.
Okay.
So when it's $19.99, that means that Preacher is basically the trade paperback of the hardcover, which collected two trades at a time. So you're looking that volume collects the first two trades, or obviously the third and the fourth, or the fourth and the sixth, fourth and the fifth. You know what I mean?
So for book 6 there at rank 236, 1999, you're saying that's a trade paperback collecting two hardcovers?
No, collecting two like 6-issue arcs or 5-issue arcs or however they were. You know what I mean?
So this is where I get confused, because this one actually says it's collecting 55 through 60, whereas book 5 above it is collecting issues 41 through 54.
Yeah, see, that's where sometimes I don't know where you're getting the like description, but that's oftentimes where Amazon will mess up. I don't know where that's pulling from, or if it's pulling from Diamond, but
I'm pulling it from Diamond, and odds are they are too.
Yeah, and there are. So the other thing to remember about Preacher is it had those few offshoots. So when they put the series out as a continuous, when they redid the packaging and everything, a few of them might have been bigger. So they, you know what I mean? Because they had to fit in the side stories, like the Saint of Killers or whatever. And they had a few little side stories that they had to package in. So there might be a few books that they still have in print that they're doing only the 5 or 6 pages. But the mainline story, they basically reissued, they had, you know, they had the a bunch of trades, you know, five or six issues. Then they reissued him in hardcovers where they doubled up, two trades per hardcover. And then they released those hardcovers, which are still two trades, but in paperback, right?
Okay.
So it's, you know, obviously a different ISBN, but they collected it. I think the total run I have for the entire series in those two, I have it in the paperback form, in the two chunk is six trade paperbacks, but each trade paperback has at least two story arcs, basically.
All of these are book 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my system was out of ignorance, I was thinking book and volume were synonymous.
Yeah. So I'm looking at right now Preacher Book 6, and it's the concluding volume. It has issues 55 through 66. And then there's also a one shot, Tale in the Saddle, like the special. So.
It's interesting because the description here is saying 55 through 60 plus that special.
Yeah.
But 66 would make more sense.
Yeah, that's the thing is, I would think that they've sold through all those original, like, you know, those original ones, and that this is the only thing they're printing now is the trade paperback version of the hardcovers, which had two of the original trade paperbacks in it. So
no, and that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What I'm doing now is I'm digging up the solicitation blurb and just see if it had it kind of confusing for that book 6.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm curious why it's saying 60 when it should be 66. This is the thing that really just drives me nuts with the trade side, is these things over time will change price point, which makes sense. I mean, you know, paper gets more expensive over time, etc. But then they'll also kind of change how they collect the stuff, mm-hmm. from the size of the original trade to a bigger trade or what have you.
Yep.
Yeah, they had it 55 through 60 there. All right. So it's at one point I had the system actually being able to coordinate the collected edition with what was in it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was when I had more time on my hands because I was manually entering a lot of that data.
Yeah.
At some point I may see if I can get clever and kind of automate some of that. But I'd love to be able to see how did these do compared to the first, you know, the component issue sales.
Mm-hmm.
But again, every volume of it on the list, probably not a coincidence that it's on TV right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
One trade that I do want to point out, because I think it's one of the few Aftershock ones we've seen on the list, although actually there's two. The one I was going to point out was at rank 124 for Super Zero Volume 1, 1,005 units. A couple of ranks above it is Insects with 1,028 units. Aftershock, again, seems to have some really good talent, doing some good stories. We'll see if it becomes kind of a more permanent fixture in the industry or not.
Yeah, that is interesting. Those numbers for that brand new of a company, I wonder, you know, I guess it'll just be more of, we'll just have to see going forward if they have any sort of traction, if they get any sort of reorder activity, or, you know, we'll just have to see.
Well, and they're doing miniseries, so they may have some great ones, but if they don't continue to have new, interesting, great ones, you know, are they still going to be around?
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, it's for a newer company, I think it's hard to really get your foot in the door in the industry and get a firm enough position there to be an ongoing concern, whereas it's ridiculously easy to have had that and then have something change and suddenly you don't have that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, Red 5 Comics, I was loving everything they were doing. They were coming out with a lot of stuff. Don't know what quite happened. They throttled back a little bit on their output. Atomic Robo moved over to IDW after a brief point of digital only.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, Red 5, I think, is still doing some stuff, but it's not as frequent and they're not as much on my radar as a result. And they're still a great, great guys, great company, you know, but it was one of those that one of their kind of anchor books of Atomic Robo, you know, it was a mutual parting of ways or whatever. No hard feelings on either side, from what I gather. And the stuff they've kind of, I don't say replaced it with, but filled that slot with, isn't as much to my liking, you know. And kind of the other counterpoint to that is Titan Comics at one point was doing a little bit here, a little bit there, Number Cruncher, a few things like that. But then they get the Doctor Who license, and it's like suddenly they've gotten really serious about doing comics. They're doing doing Torchwood, they're doing a bunch of stuff.
That actually is interesting that you bring that up, because one of the ones I did highlight is at rank 300, Doctor Who 10th, the 10th Doctor, Volume 5, with 435 units, you know, and I see a pretty a little bit further up, there's another Doctor Who, the 11th Doctor, Volume 3. I'm just wondering, these numbers are not what I would consider successful, and they have tons of books across all the different Doctors. And I'm wondering, is this really an oversaturation? Because there's just so much product out there for this. And is 435 for the first month good for this? I just don't know what their licensing fee is. But man, that doesn't seem very exciting. And maybe it's because it's the fifth volume for that 10th Doctor and everyone else has had to save their money to spend all, across all the other Doctors. But that does not seem successful to me, at least in the direct market.
It's also for the hardcover and they do trades.
Yes. Yeah. Okay.
So people may get the trades. The 10th Doctor Volume 3 trade paperbacks at rank 284 with 462. I think part of what's going on here is they've got the license for Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that is the license singular for Doctor who is essentially plural. So if you're paying a certain licensing fee, which I believe is over time, and I could be wrong on this, you've got the ability of doing, you know, one or two books on the current Doctor or whatever, or kind of doing what they're doing. And that's, they've got like, I think five Doctors going concurrently. So If they're paying the same licensing fee, and again, I don't know if they are renting the license over time or if they're paying, you know, per issue or how exactly the term of their deal is. But there does seem to be a point where if you can just keep going, why not?
Yeah.
It comes down to, again, how much are they really paying for this stuff? Presumably it's working out for them. Otherwise they wouldn't keep going. But most of these things are on the comic side doing under 10,000. I'm going to say they're hovering around the, 7,500 mark or whatever. So it's not like they're burning up the charts, but if you're able to make money on that, and presumably they are, or they wouldn't keep doing yet another Doctor. Because some of them are miniseries or whatever, but right now, every current Doctor since they restarted, Eccleston, Tennant, Smith, and Capaldi, all have ongoing titles. And many of them have gotten to where they've gotten on to a year two. In one case, I think they're even starting up the third year of it. Plus, they've been doing a miniseries for the 8th Doctor, the 4th Doctor, and I think they may have one other in the works.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes down to how much is your overhead, how much are you paying the license fee, and more importantly with this title than most others, how are your UK sales doing?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because we're predominantly talking about North American sales on this list, and this, of course, is a huge property in the UK. But I think a lot of it comes down to these may not be great numbers for a Marvel or DC book, but I'm willing to bet this is something that would do a little better than average in the mass market.
Mm-hmm.
More people are familiar with Doctor Who than, say, name a middle rung, you know, Marvel DC character. So
yeah, that's a good point.
I don't think they're raking in money hand over fist, but I think this is something that seeing the long tail on this stuff is going to be interesting. I'm also curious how this is doing in digital. Because I think this is something that, like I said, will have a longer lifespan than many other properties. Now, one of the things I noticed a little lower on the list, well, not as low as 300, obviously, is there were a couple of items with just some crazy retail rankings. It looks like Marvel was blowing out a couple of books at discount. Onslaught Unleashed, Spider-Man, Zombies Christmas Carol, X-Force Volume 2, Wolverine Black Cat Claws 2. And some of these were just crazy retail rankings, you know, whereas they should have had somewhere in, say, like with the Claws 1, somewhere between a retail ranking of 265 and 310, it had 2,093.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, some of the stuff, they're just aggressively discounting.
Yeah, and they do that, I wouldn't say regularly, but they'll do it a couple times a year for sure.
Yeah, definitely happens.
Yeah,
I think it just comes down to as they're looking over their inventory and what they've got more than enough of. It's like, well, why hang on to it?
Yeah,
you know, move it out.
And it's pretty clear. It's a policy from the top down saying, you know, once you hit this certain inventory, you guys got to move it. So,
or once it gets, I was gonna say once it gets past a certain age, but these are, some of these are from, let's see, August 2012, June 11, September. So yeah, some of it may be aged, some of it may not be.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it's had its time to sell and it hasn't. So why hang on to it?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Another one that's kind of interesting is at rank 206. We got Miraculous Tales of Ladybug and Cat Noir Volume 1. This is from Action Labs Entertainment. It's been on the list one other time before. 674 units this time, a total of 1,345 units. What I find interesting about this is they solicited the trade pretty much concurrently with the issues. It was one that I was initially debating which one do I go get.
Huh, I didn't realize that.
They did the first three issues in one order form along with the trade for it. And then I think along with the trade, the solicitation for this one, actually. And then I think they also did the same with 4, 5, and 6. And this was, I believe, a digest size, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
What I also find interesting about this particular property, it's a computer generated animated series. And they're using the art from the series for the comic. So, I mean, literally, if you were to do freeze framing at the right time while watching an episode, they just grab that, toss it onto the page, but not in terms of a grid panel layout.
Uh-huh.
They've actually got somebody doing a pretty good job on making it feel like a comic book layout. So it's, to me, it's a very successful translation of the comic, or from the animated series into a comic book. And it's one that I don't think would work with live action. This approach probably would work with standard animation if anyone were to still do that today.
Mm-hmm.
But they're literally just adapting the episodes straight to print.
Interesting.
And I'm curious what audience is looking for that, given that this stuff is also available on DVD. So you can just watch the episode. So it's interesting. I think it was a good move for Action Labs to get the property and go with it. So I thought that was interesting. Based on this having first shipped at the end of July, I'm thinking it's the order just kind of got split with maybe one distribution center getting it just in time to get it out the last of July and the other one not getting it in time and getting it out at the beginning of August.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
But who knows? It could just be that there's that much reorder activity. We'll probably have a better sense of that with the next volume.
Yeah.
So what else grabbed your attention this time around?
I did find it interesting how much below 300 they gave you. That's quite a bit of exposure there.
Yes. Yes. I was surprised. We go as far as rank, 719.
Mm-hmm.
The way the list is, the way I get my data is they publish a list of the top 300 trades. They then publish a list of the top 50 small and independent, two lists, one for small, one for independent trades. And I always get them backwards as to how they define them. I think the small is anything more or less other than like Marvel, other than maybe the premier publishers. Because there's certain publishers that drop out between the different lists.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the fact that we went so far down, granted, we've got a ton of gaps between a lot of these, but we've got, 64 items below the radar, which is pretty cool. A lot of them are from Viz, Hatchet, Tokyo Pop, St. Martin's Press, Humanoids. So the further down, it gets a little bit more kind of off the beaten path or whatever. But sometimes this is the only visibility we get for some publishers.
That makes sense.
These are things that are selling somewhere between 300 and 430 units. So it's not a ton, but depending how much you've invested in the material, and some of this is getting to be translations of manga and things like that, you may not have to flip that many units to make a profit.
Yeah.
And if it's something that's been on the list before, and we'll say a quarter or a third of these items have been, that helps too, because you can build up the recouping your cost, over time.
Mm-hmm. Well, and some other things are series that have been, like if you look at item 435, 435, it's the Dragon Ball 3-in-1. So this is material that has been in print for decades, and it's just in a different format. They're putting three of the individual volumes into one. So this is, you know, the found money principle. Find different ways to package it. Obviously, you have to meet your production costs, but you know, this is the you know, there's a bunch of these, and there's just, you know, more ways to make money off the property that's already been paid for. You know, this is a 20-year, 25-year-old property. So
exactly. Not only is it there with the, that Dragon Ball one, but a few ranks above it, Bleach is doing the same sort of a thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then we've got like an omnibus or two in here, a few others that are, again, collections of collections.
Yeah.
And I think there's that found money aspect, but it's one that you've got to be careful with, because I think if readers are feeling, well, if I just waited longer, I could have gotten in the format I really wanted it. There's also the lost money aspect.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Because you got to be careful how you're training your readers. But for some of the stuff that's been in print, you know, for again, a decade or something, getting a new collection of it makes sense.
Yeah. Well, and one of the other things that is interesting in terms of the manga world is, oftentimes for affordability, when they do the three-in-ones, they print it on cheaper paper. And it's, you know, obviously for a property like Dragon Ball, you know, that's been out for like 25 years, you know, maybe they're hoping to catch interest of people who have never seen it, who are just coming of age for that age bracket now. And so, you know, it's an inexpensive way to kind of get in and get them into the series. You know, it's a really, you know, it's a pretty long series. I think there's like 40 or 50 volumes in the total set. And this is the first of, you know, first three-in-one of them. And so, you know, kind of a good way to reintroduce maybe a generation that hasn't been exposed to it. Obviously, with the cartoon being so popular, a lot of kids have been exposed to it. But, you know, as the time goes by, new kids are born, and those kids definitely haven't seen it as they age up. And, you know, these forms are really accessible for those to kind of get a big chunk of the story to see if you like it.
I do think there's a lot to be said for getting some of the older material out in front of a younger audience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that when I was first getting into comics, they were still doing reprint titles as comic books or as digests. So I was reading a lot of the old, you know, Legion of Superhero stuff when it was being reprinted in Adventure Comics as a digest.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, other formats like that. And at one point they were doing oversized comics, not oversized, but thicker comics or whatever, reprinting some of the old Dead Man stories or Batman stories or stuff like that. And again, it's just a way to do a new printing of old material that, you know, again, gets it in front of a new audience. You know, it's something that I don't think the publishers are necessarily doing as great of a job of as they could, but I think it's also so much more of a crowded market now than it was back then.
Yeah.
I mean, the shipment I just got from DCBS, I think, is more comics than I was getting when I was in high school and college and stuff in a month.
Huh.
And I was still pretty much all in at the time. It's just there's so much more coming out, and it's coming out faster.
Yeah.
Speaking of reading habits, we did have some questions on the forum for you.
Okay.
I thought I'd toss them out. These come from Drew, again, Weekly Comic Spotlight co-host. First question, do you get your DCBS shipment monthly?
Yes, I do.
Makes sense. Save on the shipping. Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Follow-up question to that is, do you devour all your trades right away or stretch them out through the month?
Well, so that's interesting. One of the reasons I get my shipment monthly is because I have such a backlog, because, you know, I primarily shop through DCBS, but every once in a while they'll have a great sale at in-stock trades, or every Christmas there's one or two other online retailers for trades, and every Christmas or Black Friday they'll have a really good sale, have like a clearance, and so I'll always know those days to go on there and look to see if I can complete parts of my collection or something for a good price. So I always have plenty to read, so there's no reason for me to get weekly shipping because I already have too much of a backlog. And it really depends. You know, it depends on my mood. Sometimes I'll open something out of the box and be like, ooh, I've wanted to read this right now, and I'll read it as soon as I get it. Other times I'll be like, well, oh, I'm excited that I got this, but I have all this other stuff I need to get to first, and so it goes into the pile.
Yeah, I know how that goes. It's for me, I do that with the weekly comics and stuff, but yeah, trades sit around unread for me for a while.
Yeah.
His next question was, when you say you're limited by budget, is it dollars or time?
Interestingly, for me, it initially started out as by dollars, But as I've, you know, I've gotten a better job recently and had a little bit more, the financial side has gone up. But now, because I'm working a little bit more and my living situation is a little bit different, I have less time than I used to for reading. So now it's switched from dollars to time. But also, I realize that with less time, my to-be-read stack keeps building up. So it's almost like, should I be pouring more money into it and burying myself deeper? So now it's more of a time issue.
No, I get how that goes. It's like, I don't have time to read what I've got, so should I artificially throttle the dollars to not have it grow as fast?
Yeah, because it's otherwise I'm just, you know, there's always more that I would love to buy. You know, if I had your budget, I probably could find enough to buy, but there is just, the time is more of a problem for me now.
Well, Drew's follow-up question was, what would you add if you had more of whichever, or in this case, it would be time?
Oh, absolutely time. I have shelves full of graphic novels that I want to read and collect editions that I want to read. And I actually, for my favorite, I have like a one shelf that I keep my favorite series on. And every, like at least once a year, I try to reread one of the bigger series, you know, like, you know, every couple years I try to reread Sandman, or every couple years I'll reread another series. Like right now I'm in the middle of a Hellblazer read because they're, DC is releasing the chunks of the Hellblazer 300 issue series. So, but you know, when you commit to that, then you don't have time for the newer stuff kind of thing. So.
Yeah, I think that's really tough to do. I mean, that's part of why I don't do the back issue spotlights very often, is finding the time to squeeze in that much additional reading while, I was going to say, staying current on comics, or in my case right now, catching up on comics. Mm-hmm. It's just tough to do.
Yeah. So I try to make time. And the overarching principle I always operate under is, one of the reasons I stepped away from comics when I was in college is I got burnt out trying to keep up with everything. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that I don't get into that situation. So I always make sure, even if something I have my to be read pile ordered and what I would like to read in a certain order, but if something jumps on to me or my mood changes and I want to pick something else, I don't stop myself from doing that, because I don't want to get back into that situation where I feel like it's almost a chore to read and I have to get through, quote unquote, this material this week because I have to get through it. I don't want to get into that situation because I'm afraid I'll fall out of love with comics again and you know, might stop for another time.
No, I hear you on that. That's something that particularly around Comic-Con time every year when I get behind, it's balancing wanting to get caught up but not wanting to feel like I've just got to slog through stuff.
Yeah.
Because some of it, I just got to be in the right frame of mind to read.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, with the different genres that I read, some days I'm up for a superhero. Like this last week or two, I've been reading a lot of Valiant. You know, I just kind of immersed myself in the Valiant universe. But before that, I was reading a lot of autobiography and comics and stuff like that. So it just really depends on what I'm in the mood for.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. His next question was, are there books you passed on that you regret, or have you pretty much read everything you wanted?
Oh, I think there's there's always books that you I think my biggest I probably would say my biggest regret in terms of collected editions is the Starman hardcover set.
Mm.
I was waiting for it to come to softcover, and so I didn't buy any of the hardcovers, and now they didn't have enough demand apparently and to solicit past the third of the six paperbacks of the hardcovers. But the problem is because the hardcover's now out of print, the price to get the series is, you know, for the first three volumes that are out of print, you're looking at $100+ per volume for a $50 cover price. And the back three, you can only get in hardcover. And I don't like mixing and matching trade paperback and hardcover in a series. So I've kind of screwed myself in terms of, that's the one regret I probably have of all the collected editions, because I really like that story.
Yeah.
I really like that story. It's kind of like, it's almost Vertigo-esque for me in terms of like that long story. You see the development of the character, his relationship with his father, that whole thing. And I'm kind of like, I want a physical form of that because I have it all in digital, but I'd love to have those hardcovers, but they're so expensive now.
Well, and this is where I think the publishers, particularly on the trade side, are really putting themselves in a really awkward situation, because they've essentially trained readers to wait for the format they want.
Mm-hmm.
Which means they don't get the sales up front of the other formats, regardless of what order they publish stuff in.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, oh, they should always do trade first or hardcover first, whatever. I mean, there are going to be people who want one or the other, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's kind of in that situation where they decide, okay, we did the hardcovers first. we're doing the trades, there's not enough demand for the trades, so we're going to stop the trades. I almost think they should be obligated to then do at least one more printing of the hardcovers and tell people that they're doing that.
Yeah.
But then if they do that and there's demand for that, they'd be thinking, well, wait, maybe there is demand for the trades, so we should do the trades. And you're going to be thinking, but you just got me to buy the hardcover.
Yeah. And it's been such a tortured trail. So they solicited the first two trade paperbacks of the hardcovers, six hardcovers. And, you know, that they were in a, you know, pretty good cadence. And so then the third one came out. And the third solicit came out, and then it got canceled for not orders. And then like a year later, they resolicited the third one, and I got my hopes up thinking, oh, they're going to finish it. They're, you know, they've finally come back up in the publishing queue, so I made sure to order it. And then like 2 or 3 weeks after the orders were due, I got the email from DCBS saying, oh, they've canceled this, and they'll resolicit. And I was like, oh, they must have not got enough orders again. So yeah. I think it might be totally dead this time, and I'm just
Well, I think they need to, and not just DC, I mean all the publishers, for those sorts of things, have a way that you can sign up as declaring interest in this, that, or the other.
Yeah.
To give them some indication of is it worth going back to print? And then when they're thinking they are, they should just email, hey, we're thinking about this. Click here if you really are serious about this.
Well, and I think part of the problem with when they resolicited it a year later is I think a lot of people missed it because they just had completely, you know, it's a year later after they'd done it. So who the hell was looking at their previews and seeing a Starman solicit in the bottom of a corner in the, you know, in that certain section? It's like, I saw it just because I've thought about that series enough. I know exactly what the trade dress looks like. So it literally, my eye was rolling over the page and I immediately went back to it. But that's just because it's a series that, not necessarily like a white whale thing for me, but it's like the one that got away. The one that I'm usually very good at planning ahead, like especially with Marvel Omnibuy. I know that they don't overprint on those. So if I really want a Marvel Omnibuy, I pre-order that because I know that I'll be screwed if I don't order it. But you know, that's the one of the series that I planned, but I didn't plan well, or it just got me in the end.
Well, I mean, for me, I had similar sort of, you know, is it in print? Am I ever going to find it with the Nicolai Dante series that 2001 AD did with DC? They're no longer with DC. They're doing their own thing. I don't know if they're ever going to get to the volumes I want. But then in terms of the it's been so long, I've forgotten about it kind of a deal. I was getting the Uncle Scrooge Donald Duck two-pack, you know, slipcase hardcovers from Fantagraphics. But it's like, I'm not pouring through their solicit each and every month.
Yeah.
And so maybe they've done more and I've missed. Matter of fact, I think one of them, and I'm not sure if it's part of the same series or not, but it rank 341, the Disney Rosa Duck Library Volume 3 Richest Duck is in there from Fantagraphics. So again, is this part of this? Is it not? It's like I'm a casual enough fan that it's easy for me to get a little confused by some of this. So, yeah. And let's see, Drew had two more questions. The next one is, what are some of the under-the-radar titles/trades that not a lot of folks are reading but should be?
Ooh, that is a good question. You know, it's funny that you bring it up, but I really think that an underrated, and maybe part of it is Fantagraphics, and not a lot of people get to that back section of the book, but the Don Rosa and the Carl Barks Duck comics are some of the best stories ever. And people, you know, people might turn their nose up being like, oh, those are for kids. There are great stories in there. They're great stories for all ages. And it's such good cartooning. You know, the Don Rosa stuff I really like, but obviously Carl Barks, you know, being one of the three first people into the cartooning the Eisner Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. You know, he's just a master of being able to tell great stories. And I just love those books. So I would say those are criminally underrated, even though, you know, almost everyone knows about, you know, those characters. They don't necessarily know about the great comics from the past. So I would say that was one of the top ones. What else off the top of my head?
I would say for Scrooge, if you're gonna start with Scrooge, The Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck is the way to go.
That is
some of the classic stuff. It's just terrific.
Yeah. I would say I always put in a good word for Usagi Yojimbo from Dark Horse. I think that that is one of the best ongoing series that can be read by any age. I have the kind of big books that they've been putting out the last year and a half or so that collect like three of the trades. And he has what, almost probably 170 issues of that. When you add up all over the couple volumes, you know, he did a series of it at Fantagraphics, and then he switched to Dark Horse. But Usagi Yojimbo is awesome. And I think everyone should give that one a chance for sure.
Yeah, that was one I was really late to the game on. I think I got on around issue 116, 118, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. But I've since gotten I think it was the Fantagraphics 2 hardcover slipcase. Mm-hmm. And then all of the trades up until where I had picked up on the comics from Dark Horse. That's one that if I had unlimited time and whatnot, would love to go through all of those.
Yeah.
Sakai is just doing just such a great job on that book.
Well, and he's just generally, he's such a good storyteller, and it always keeps you entertained. And you know, each of his tales has its own individual story. But if you're willing to, like I said, invest the time in reading, you know, from the beginning, so many of the characters develop over time. And you just, there's these little stories that are always flowing through each of his tales that are from, you know, he gives hints back to old stories and references. And it's just great. It's great comics, man. Not every comic has to be, you know, exploding world-ending affairs. These are great, just like personal stories that he tells about Usagi, and I really like that series a lot. Another one that, you know, I don't think is underrepresented in your podcast, you know, podcast in your realm, but again, Atomic Robo. Now it's to wider reference for, you know, with being at IDW, I still think it's criminally underrated. That's a great series. You know, whenever someone asks me for comics that I can recommend to almost anyone, I talk about Usagi, I talk about Atomic Robo. You know, I talk about, you know, if you can handle a little bit darker, you know, the BPRD, the Hellboy stuff. I really think that they're just great stuff there that sometimes people, when a series goes on long enough and it's just consistently good, it gets lost in the everyday hundreds of issues always being published. You know, we talk about how good Saga is, and some people don't talk about it anymore just because, well, there's 14 new number ones coming out. We got to talk about that. But there, you know, certain books are still good, even though there's new stuff coming out, you know?
Well, absolutely. And I think both Usagi and Atomic Robo are ones that should be kind of perennials, that evergreen kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're good stories. Both have numerous entry points. I think almost every issue of Usagi is accessible.
Absolutely.
And certainly every trade story, every arc or whatever with Atomic Robo. But in both cases, it's like we're getting to follow the life story of these characters.
Mm-hmm.
In Usagi's, it's more or less chronological order. For Atomic Robo, we're definitely bouncing around in time a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a sense of I don't see reality there, but of not, we're telling a story that just happens to have these characters. We're exploring this character's life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a subtle, but I think important distinction.
Yeah. So those would be the few that are off the top of my head, that I can think of. If people are interested in trying a little bit more of a European flair, the last year and a half, the IDW European comic imprint has been putting out the Hugo Pratt Corto Maltese, with the definitive translations that are actually good translations. One of the problems is a different company had done a poor translations of the first couple of books, and they sold really poorly over here due to the translation. And so that kind of stunted his appeal over here for some reason. And that was a number of years ago, but they finally got that straightened out. And IDW has properly been giving these books the presentation that they deserve. And it's a great story. And Hugo Pratt, his line and his ability to do action cartooning is almost unparalleled. So kind of for a great European adventure comic, I would recommend the Corto Maltese by Hugo Pratt.
I can definitely see where a bad translation could definitely impact somebody's enjoyment of a story.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a shame that had happened and took a while to get over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, it was so bad that it affected their publishing strategy of the series for IDW. They literally, so there's a bunch of different stories for the Corto Maltese line, and they basically skipped the first two because those were the two that the other company had done, and they didn't want to start. They were worried that there was such a bad taste in the market for how badly those previous versions have been done. They skipped those two, and they've published the four stories after it. And I think they're eventually going to go back to the first two. And it's good in that sense that the way that it's told, it's, you know, episodic in his adventures. So you don't necessarily need that great introduction. But that, you know, it affected their publishing plan. They actually have not published the beginning of his stories, the first couple, because of how badly that had sold in the market. And they just didn't want to get contaminated by that.
Well, in even aside from the translation issue, the fact that that had already gotten out to the market, mm-hmm. it would be hard to gauge the real interest in the property because, well, some people it's like, yeah, but I've already got a copy.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
So that's kind of an awkward situation to be in. So it sounds like they did the right thing.
Yeah. No, and it's you know, IDW usually does a good job with their trade dress. They're oversized trade paperbacks, and they're really, really well done. So.
Well, and IDW tends to seem to take the long view on the properties. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to milk a property dry as quickly as they can. It's like, can we make this work? Can we make it work for the long term? And I think that's really paid off for them because they've got some, I think, very strong relationships, it seems like, with the people they're licensing stuff from. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think we'd be getting the Revolution stuff with Hasbro if they had a shaky relationship with them on the comic side at IDW.
Oh, absolutely.
And I've got to think that the relationship with IDW is part of what led to not only this kind of comic universe going on, but this is, I think, an offshoot of the bigger Hasbro universe going in the movies and stuff. But I think that's also kind of a reflection of, well, Marvel's got a cinematic universe. Why can't Hasbro? Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's, again, long-term view of the properties, I think, is always the right approach for the licensed, comics to take. And the final question Drew had, and I think this is an interesting one. Being a trade reader exclusively, don't you miss letter columns?
Interesting. I guess I did not grow up in the era when they were as great as they, you know, I hear from so many people who grew up in the 70s and 80s and really kind of came into their comics. You know, that was their era. I didn't start reading comics until the like mid 90s. And so that was that during that Image boom and everything. And it was, you know, I was just so focused on the art and the story. It wasn't an area of emphasis for me. So, and I've just, since it's never been part of my comics experience, I don't really, it's almost like I didn't know it was something that I was missing. So I didn't, it's just not something I pay attention to. You know what I mean? It's like, so the same way that like, one of the things I always, give IDW and Boom a hard time for is when they're doing their collected editions of only four issues, they always put a bunch of like sketches or process in the back to kind of fill out the volume so it's not a 90 page trade paperback. Mm-hmm. That stuff for the majority of creators I actually have no interest in. So where some people love that process stuff, some people love the blue extras and the Blu-ray, I don't, that stuff does almost nothing for me. I'm there for the story and the art, and there are very few creators, maybe with the exception of people like Paul Pope or J.H. Williams III, where I actually would want to look at how they develop their material and their process. And that's just a quirk of me. You know, I completely understand and respect people that really love the extras on Blu-rays and that really love that back matter or the columns in the back of certain things. But for me, it just doesn't do anything for me. So I don't really feel like I've lost anything when I read the trade editions.
So I guess the question I have for you is, at one point, and I'm thinking, you know, way back, maybe 10 years ago or more, trades seem to have a lot more of that additional material than they seem to mm-hmm. now. And I'm kind of okay with that as a reader of the individual issues, because mm-hmm. there's an aspect where it's like I'm kind of sort of subsidizing the creation of these trades. And then for the people who skip that process to get the benefit and a bonus for getting mm-hmm. straight to trade, or going straight for the trade and skipping the individual issues, it kind of is annoying. It's like, I don't want to have to pay again just for the backup material.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how the market is kind of segmented. You have some creators who believe, especially at Image, people like Brubaker, who will put an Fraction, who will put back matter only in the single issues to try and get people to buy the single issues, and they say they won't be in the trades. And for the most part, they honor that. Then there are people who won't put a lot of back matter in the cheap trades, but they'll put them in the hardcovers and the omnibus to draw, you know, to say, oh, there's extra material, so there's a reason why you'd want to purchase this one. So there's different strategies for that, you know. But some of it's almost like the business strategy, not necessarily like. And then there are other creators, like I think Brian K. Vaughan. He really likes interacting with his readers in the back pages. And there are other readers, I can't remember which comic it was, that creator that really likes it when his readers send him pictures of their cats you know, and so there's just, it totally varies on which creator likes what and how they interact with their fans or how they use that extra material to promote different versions of their product, you know?
Yeah, and I see the need to have something in the trade, then the hardcover, then the omnibus to entice people that may already have them and such. Mm-hmm. It just seems like a double-edged sword sometimes.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the last thing you want to do is have people realize they really wanted what was in the omnibus, so they'll skip the trade, they'll skip the hardcover, they'll skip the monthly issue. At which point, I mean, if I've skipped three versions of the material, I got to remember to buy it on the fourth, and it's had the time for word of mouth to either praise it or damn it. And, yeah. You know, that's an influence, too. And yeah. Are you even still reading comics that long later?
Yeah. And, you know, to go back to Drew's point, it's kind of interesting he talks about the letter pages, because one of the things that I do like about the Marvel Omnibuy is that most of them try to include the letter pages from the issues, especially the older stuff. And I can see the appeal to some of that, because in the past, they were willing to publish long form communication, and from issue to issue, you could see the back and forth between the creator or the fans, because you'd have people that write in consistently. And so that I could see the draw to that, but it just wasn't such a central part of my comics reading experience that it just, you know, just wasn't something I focused on.
Yeah, I think it's a matter of when you got into comics as to whether the letter page was a big deal or not.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I don't even miss it in the books it's not in these days.
Yeah. Well, and you know, in the past, it was always interesting, too. You'd see, if you go back far enough, you'd see future creators writing in to their mentors and or the creators they looked up to, and either asking them, like, how do you do this? It's so amazing. Or arguing with them about certain things, or arguing with them about plots, or arguing with them about superhero powers. And, you know, the letters pages are filled with today's creators, you know, writing in to complain about something to the 70s and 80s creators, you know?
Oh, absolutely. But we're so far from the time where you would have kind of known letter hacks, as they were called, yeah. Or whatever. You know, the TM Maples or what have you, mm-hmm. that would just write to everybody. And it's like, well, if you haven't gotten a letter from him, you're not worth reading, kind of a deal. It's just, we're not in that day and age.
Yeah. So it is interesting, though, because, like, I a number of the other podcasts I listen to, they have members that, you know, that's like when they go back issue bin diving, half of the reason is they want to read the letter pages from those old comics. You know what I mean? That's like half the reason they're doing that. So.
Oh, I totally get that.
Yeah.
One of the things that was a pleasant discovery for me about a year or two back was when I was on mycomicshop.com looking around for some stuff, I happened to notice they actually mark which issues have the statement of ownership in them.
Ah.
I talk about even drier reading than a letter page where there at least could be some good vitriol or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, for me in the numbers and stuff, that's the kind of thing. It may influence, you know, do I get this issue or that or something. I mean, I'm still going to get it for the story, but
yeah,
no, I totally get that.
Good stuff, though. Yeah, no, I like those questions.
No, those are definitely good questions. I just think reading, as a readership, as an audience, we've segmented into those kind of like myself that are reading the individual issues. Those kind of like yourself that are predominantly or almost exclusively trade readers, we then have that other audience that's almost exclusively digital. Obviously, there's people that overlap across those.
Mm-hmm.
But it makes for very different reading experiences across them.
Absolutely.
And it's just interesting to me how we've got a good metric for new comic sales, an acceptable metric here on the trade side, because obviously we're not getting the mass market. We're not getting the full picture by a long shot. But I think we're getting the core readership of comics measured through this for trades. And even when this is out of line on how a trade does in the big picture, like again, you were talking about how Black Panther, you know, it'd be really interesting to see how the mass market does there, because it's a unique case for a particular reason. How it does in Diamond in the direct market versus how it does in the mass market is a very important metric, I think, to have. I wish we had better visibility on the digital side, because I think that kind of rounds out some of this stuff and is both the easiest market to get, technically, to get metrics from. I mean, business-wise, with Amazon, Comixology, etc., it's impossible to get those public. But at least they can easily collect them. But it's mm-hmm. also the one venue that's closest to the meritocracy, because there's zero benefit to pre-ordering the next issue of a comic until you've read the current one.
Yeah.
You know, whereas you may not like a given comic, but in my case, I've pre-ordered a couple issues. And granted, most people are getting them off the rack or whatever, but so much of this is kind of on a sight unseen basis that it takes a little bit sort of for the impact of a bad story decision, a bad creator team change, or what have you to take effect. Again, flip side is those things are usually pretty well known by the time the collected edition comes out, so those sales, not necessarily those orders, which is again what we're looking at, what was invoiced, definitely can come into play.
Yep.
Price points this time around, kind of all over the board. A lot of things at $14.99, $19.99, $9.99. Just those price points right there account for over half the sales, just 51%. $16.99. What I do like is the majority of these things are at that kind of $19.99 or below range.
Mm-hmm.
That's 78% of the sales right there. You crank it up to $25 or below, and that's 90% of the items on the list. So there are some high-ticket items out there. The high one this time was $75. I believe that was the Mike Mignola Artist Edition.
Mm-hmm.
There may have been one or two other things there, but I think again it's hit or miss as to what's released in any given month. But you know, there's not the stream of high ticket items that we used to have at one point.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's by and large a good thing. Yeah, the $75 items we had were a Spider-Man omnibus, a Deadpool minibus. Marvel Masterwork for the Incredible Hulk, Batman Golden Age Omnibus, Rachel Rising Omnibus, again, the Artist Edition from Magnolia. Everything else was under $60. It's just, I think there's so much coming out, so many things vying for people's attention. You really got to have something that's worth it to charge, you know, the $100 or more dollars for.
Oh, I completely agree. I think the affordability is, you know, obviously people are going to be interested in what they're interested in, but you can tempt them when it's affordable.
Yeah. And I think a lot of these publishers are getting better on if they have the higher ticket items to space them out over time.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that has cost IDW a little bit of my money over time is whenever they would do two of the artist edition in the same month, it's like, well, one of them I'm certainly not getting.
Oh, come on, John. You just got to cut back on those figures.
You know, I'm actually not doing as much on the figures these days as I was thinking. Probably more than I'm realizing, actually. I've got a couple of shipments coming from Image Anime. They're getting a fair amount of my money. But I'll probably talk about that on one of the collector spotlights soon.
Sounds good.
Anything else on the trades? Are we good?
No, I think it was good discussion this month.
Yeah, definitely.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes two decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50.5 or SKUs and items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully embedded in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. no visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions. They're not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists, either included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside of Diamond Comics distribution channels included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the alternate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Athlogic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.